Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of For the Medical Record. Actually, our final episode as co-hosts of For the Medical Record.
Yeah.
Antoine and I are both, at least physically, leaving Hopkins for other positions at other universities. And we're very sad to be leaving this podcast, but we thank all of our listeners. It's been so much fun to have these conversations, and we really appreciate all of your feedback, all of your hyping up of both of us. It's been great.
Yeah, we appreciate the comments. We appreciate the tweets, the virtual community that we've built here.
Yeah, I feel like we've both learned a lot.
Yes.
So our final guest for the Medical Record is Dr. Nicole Labruto, who is assistant research professor in the Department of Anthropology, as well as director of the program in Medicine, Science, and the Humanities. So MSH, and that's an undergraduate program here at Hopkins. Before having those roles, she was a postdoc fellow like us here at Johns Hopkins, and she's an anthropologist in residence at the Maryland Institute College of Art, or MICA, which she'll speak about briefly here. She is also a member of the curatorial circle of the Ecological Design Collective, which is an online platform for people interested in radical ecological futures. So we'll link to that in the show notes, as well as all of the other amazing groups and people and initiatives that Nicole mentions throughout this episode. So what do we talk about in this episode, Antoine?
Yes, I hope you are ready for some acronyms, because you will learn a lot about MSH, the Medicine, Science, and Humanities Program, STS, Science and Technology Studies. You'll learn a lot about colonialism, the Global South, the Global North, anthropology, Brazil. Just an all-around great conversation we had with Professor Labruto, who is also getting ready to take her students on a field trip to Brazil. And speaking of which, she does have a book underway, which is titled Sweet Monster, Culturing Sugarcane in Brazil.
So lots of plant chat as
yes,
well.
Yes, yes. And you'll learn a lot about sugarcane in this episode as well.
Yeah. So we hope you enjoy. And again, thank you so much for listening to us. And if you haven't listened to all of our episodes, we've got quite a hefty back catalog. So make sure you go and listen to all of those if you haven't already. Thank you so much.
Thank you again for joining us today, Nicole. It's a pleasure to have you here with us to talk about some of the amazing, outstanding work that you do here at Johns Hopkins.
Yeah, we're so excited to have you. And if you don't mind, I'll just go ahead and jump into it.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you're the director of the Hopkins Undergraduate Program, Medicine, Science, and the Humanities, or MSH. I'm sure we'll be using that acronym a lot during this interview. But you're also an anthropologist affiliated with the Hopkins Anthropology Department. And so throughout this interview, we would like to talk both about your own research as an anthropologist, as well as your role with MSH and what it means to kind of, you know, run a department like that, because it is fairly unique. Let's start with the MSH program, if you don't mind. Could you tell us about that major, that MSH major, what it offers, and what kind of students take those classes and take that major?
I started directing the Medicine, Science, and the Humanities program in 2021, and it's been such an amazing experience to work in such a unique program. There isn't anything quite like it elsewhere. Medicine, Science, and the Humanities is a program that explores interdisciplinary perspectives on the social, cultural, and historical roots of both scientific inquiry and medicine and biotechnology, systems of healing, and systems of care. We are really excited to work with 17 different humanities departments, offering students tons of opportunities to get a foundation in various humanities or humanistic social science fields so they can really, you know, understand how different disciplines are looking at critical approaches to medicine, are looking at different critical approaches to science and technology, understanding those philosophical and cultural roots of medicine, science, of healing, of dying, of environmental interactions with health and bodies in the world. We have lots of different perspectives that all these different fields bring to it. But at the core, it's really students learning about how science and medicine function in the world more broadly beyond just their STEM courses. So we have a lot of pre-med students. We're the largest humanities undergraduate major at Hopkins, which is pretty cool. And it just goes to show the value and need for such a program, for having STEM adjacent humanities, as they call them, and having the ability to think critically about science and medicine. A lot of our students, not all, but I'd say most of our students are on pre-health track. They're looking to go to med school, they're looking to go to podiatry school or dentistry school, or to become nurse practitioners or public health researchers. So while they're doing their STEM courses for that, they're also getting to learn about how these systems operate in the world beyond just the physical sciences, and that they have to take the natural science courses that they have to take, or policy courses. We really offer that critical engagement with medicine, science, and technology. So it's really exciting to see students learn that, to see the sort of the light bulbs go off and the veil lifted, and understand how these things function in the world more broadly, and the impacts of the circulation of scientific knowledge, of medical practice, of the histories of these fields. And students really, they come out changed. They really do. They come out with completely new perspectives that we in the program hope will change the way that they practice medicine, will change the way that they engage in public health research. So it's a pretty exciting place to be. I'll also add that we have a lot of humanities students who are interested in studying science, who are interested in studying medicine, who are not going to become healthcare practitioners, but who want to be humanities researchers proper, and who want to go into master's or PhDs in the humanities or humanistic social sciences. So that's also really exciting. Not everyone is here just to supplement or add to their medical careers. We also have students who are passionate about the humanities, who want to do history, who want to do philosophy, who want to do bioethics or anthropology. And so we have a ton of support for them too. And that's really exciting as well.
Why do you believe it's important to offer a major like this to undergraduates? Like, you hinted at it, but could you go a bit more in detail?
I think it's important to offer an undergraduate major like this because science, technology, and medicine are so ubiquitous in our world, and they have so much power. They have so much power over the way that the general population thinks, the way we engage with the world, the way we engage with each other. If the COVID pandemic didn't show that, the power of facts circulating, the power of a dashboard developed on a website by, in this case, by Johns Hopkins, the COVID dashboard that was receiving, I don't know, just massive amounts of visits every day as people were checking the numbers, and people really cared about that. The knowledge that was emerging on masks and social distancing, that's all medical and scientific knowledge. And so understanding how those ideas influence public health in real lives, how people's lives are affected, how it's life or death in some cases, understanding vaccine hesitancy. You know, if you didn't know, when the COVID vaccine was rolled out, there was a lot of resistance to that and a lot of social media attention and news coverage about vaccine hesitancy and there was shaming and guilt and all kinds of issues. But anybody who studied the history of medicine knows that there has been vaccine hesitancy before there were even vaccines. There's always been issues with vaccines in the general public. And so if you can anticipate that as a public health researcher or as a physician with a public platform or working with patients, if you can understand the structural issues at play in vaccine hesitancy for different kinds of populations and the different kinds of reasons for vaccine hesitancy, then you can have greater impact, right? Then you can preempt those kinds of concerns or work with people to meet them where they are, to try and get them on board or understand the importance and dispel myths, right? We have a lot of, you know, the questioning of the notion of the fact is newer in an explicit way in our history right now. So we're seeing all these competing narratives. There have always been competing narratives for knowledge and for what's the most powerful claim or what's the authoritative claim to knowledge ultimately. But I think that if we can understand that that's a historical process, it gives people tools to work within that and try to act in the best interest of public health or act in the best interest as this knowledge circulates broadly in society. So for students to get a chance to see that knowledge isn't as monolithic as it seems, to understand that there are competitions for knowledge in the world and some narratives win out over others, I think that's very important. And I also think that understanding the historical roots of science and medicine are crucial. I think most students don't understand the implications of colonialism in scientific knowledge and the necessity of the colonial project in developing science as we know it today. Science is implicated in really important ways and in critical ways that can't be disentangled from science. And medicine similarly is premised and built in so many ways on racialized knowledge, on what we would, you know, obviously consider today medical abuses and really unethical practices that have built the medical knowledge that circulates today as very normal and very matter of fact, and that does help people. So there are a lot of complexities there in the development of these fields. And I think that if students can understand those historical foundations, it makes them better poised to try to make better decisions as they go into the fields of research and as they go into any clinical practice or other kinds of research. But if they can understand this past, it will hopefully set them on course to not make similar mistakes and not perpetuate the structural inequalities that are built into science and medicine.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I'm so glad that you mentioned this importance of understanding, like, the role of, you know, imperial power and colonialism in science. I mean, my class yesterday, we were just talking about how museums are like colonial entities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my students ended up being like, so can you even, is it even possible to decolonize the museum? I'm like, That's a really good question. Yeah, and maybe we're leading you to an answer to that. Mm-hmm. And we talked a lot about medical and science museums. So it was really cool to see them come to that kind of conclusion or towards that conclusion, which was great. I wanted to jump in with a question. Actually, you mentioning COVID, I was really curious if you've seen any kind of shifts in terms of like the students who join the MSH major. Like, are they coming in it wanting to understand that historical moment that they lived through better? Like, have you seen that as kind of an inspiration for wanting to take these classes and do this major, or have you not seen that play out that way?
It's an interesting question. Have students been more likely to join the major because of the COVID pandemic? Most of the students I talked to already had family reasons or personal reasons for either wanting to become a physician and wanting a critical perspective on it, or having some other reason for an interest in it. One interesting thing about the COVID pandemic is that it's such an overwhelming aspect of students' lives. It's been such a huge, really, percentage of their lives that they've lived through, that there are things that I have assumed in the past that students would know about that they actually don't know as much about, like the opioid epidemic, for example. Students know very little about that, whereas I think a couple of years ago, students were more aware of that. But the COVID pandemic has overtaken the opioid crisis, for example, as a public health issue, as the public health issue of their time. So I think that the enormity of the COVID pandemic obscures some things. So I think that's why it's also really important to teach that, right? It's really important to help students understand the severity and scale of, say, the opioid epidemic, which, you know, of course, we cover in the class I'm teaching right now. We cover that, and students were surprised and shocked to learn about it. It hadn't touched a lot of their lives. And so I think it was really important to bring that perspective. It was wonderful because that class, we had a visiting resident named Christina Seto, who was working with Dr. Kamna Balhra as a resident in the Johns Hopkins Emergency Department. She was fantastic. She's a double major at her university as an undergrad in English and pre-med, I believe, or biology. And so she is a resident on the floor and was talking about how common it is for patients to come in looking for opioids or struggling in various ways with real pain, real chronic pain, and addiction to OxyContin, to various opioid medicines. So, you know, it was so good to have the lived experience, and MSH draws people like that. We do have visitors who come and just want to hang out and be in the space there. And so, that was quite exciting for us. Yeah, sorry, that was a bit of a tangent on the COVID pandemic. Students are really interested in it. They have perspectives on it because, yeah, they lived through it. And as kids, you know, they're kids at this point. Undergrads here experienced that in high school. And increasingly, it'll be, you know, younger and younger that kids have experienced the COVID pandemic and go to college and want to talk about it, want to learn about it, and want to make sense of it. So it's definitely an interesting topic for them to talk about, although I'm not sure if it's brought them to the major specifically. If I can go back to when you talked about the museums, it's been really interesting when we think about colonialism and science and scientific practice. We study that for weeks and weeks. Right now I'm teaching one of the core courses, which is a 200 level course on theory and methods. So we just kind of look at big themes that scholars are interested in both the medical humanities and science, technology, and society in those two fields. So we look at gender inequalities in medicine. We look at constructions of sexuality and the medicalization of sexuality. We look at race a lot, try to understand how race is always built into medicine and medicine is always racial, even if it doesn't appear to be at first. And we take on these big topics and themes. And so in the beginning of the class, it's structured to focus on science and think about how a fact became a thing in the world that has credence and validity, working all the way up historically into, you know, through colonialism and those practices. But we kind of end that by looking at how today Global South scholars are still so infrequently cited in Global North studies. They just don't. And there's, you know, all kinds of metrics that are very easy to find about how it's really a struggle for Global South scientists to gain validity in the dominant scientific paradigms in each field. They can't get there. And so that you have this systemic inequality that's still built in today. And that theme came up over and over and over again throughout the whole rest of the semester, where students were like, it's just like we learned about how Global South scholars can't can't get a leg up because first, you know, English being the primary language of science and the circulation of scientific knowledge is, but even Global South scholars who do the thing and learn English and are completely fluent or publishing it, they still just don't, they don't have the same access to be, to change knowledge, to make impacts in those kinds of fields. They're just cited less. And there's not a lot of interdisciplinary work between Global North and Global South scholars that could promote the careers and career trajectories of Global South scholars who are doing amazing work, pioneering work in their fields. So it's just that, you know, it's great to see that students understand these even citation practices, which is such an important part of how science gets built, is through citations, is through, is how careers get built, but also how knowledge gets bolstered and created and circulates. So I think it's so important for them as they become, even as they're doing humanities work, to say, well, am I only citing Global North scholars here? Am I perpetuating this system of inequality that's always been about extracting resources or various knowledge forms from the South for the benefit of the Global North, for use to, you know, in the Global North to advance the careers of Global North scholars solely? You know, am I doing that too? So I think it's really important for them to understand those citational practices too. And they get that, which is great, coming out of learning the history of colonialism in science.
Do you mind describing what we define as the Global South and the Global North?
Great question. Thank you, Antoine. So the Global South as a concept has a really long history, which I can give like a 50-minute lecture on. So I'll try and summarize this. In the sciences, there's, because of the colonial endeavor, there have been major perceptions of the fundamental differences between imperial centers of power, Europe, and the places that they went and colonized and brought their knowledge, brought their power systems, brought forms of finance and took from, right? Took biological specimen from, took traditional knowledge practices from. And so those places, especially in like a field of anthropology, have been framed in the past as primitive, have been framed in the past as less than. And so then, and this is in the 19th century, you see this kind of framing of the superiority of the European and increasingly North American at that time centers of power and the kinds of knowledge that come out of there versus places that were considered backwards, that were considered less than, that were colonized places. So this changes in the early 20th century. You see cultural relativism coming to the fore through figures like Franz Boas, who say cultures aren't less than, they're simply different from, and everyone has a different way of understanding the world, and some aren't better than others. Everyone is simply different. This is kind of the idea of diversity and valuing diversity. And so in the critical social sciences, there's a move towards developed and developing instead. Again, this is still following on the unilinear evolutionism, but it's a little bit more neutral because the idea is that everyone is capable. At least the developing countries in this paradigm are capable, whereas in previous frameworks, they weren't even capable, right? They were racialized and sort of cast aside as not capable of even reaching the level of advancement, quote unquote, of European centers of knowledge. So then you have in the 1950s, 60s, Emanuel Wallerstein and other world systems theorists who start thinking instead about developing, because that still seems like there's an ultimate point to get to. You get to the idea of first world, second world, third world. First, second, third world. We'll still hear about the first world versus the third world, right? Third world being countries that are poorer, that are developing economically. Second world referred to Soviet and communist countries. So you don't hear a lot about the second world anymore, even though, of course, there are still communist countries. And the reason for first, second, third world actually had to do with the French Revolution and the estates, the first estate, the second estate, and the third estate. But actually, it sounds like a ranking. So critical scholars once again said, okay, even though it's premised on this historical notion of a first estate, a second estate, and a third estate from the French Revolution, it sounds like a ranking. So what's a better way? And so the term Global South and Global North were developed as a more neutral and geographic description of these places that have very unequal access to resources, very unequal economic development because of the structural conditions that were imposed in the post-colonial world order. So Global North is the places that extract. These are the places that where knowledge coalesces and is concentrated, and more importantly, where wealth is concentrated. So you have the removal of wealth and resources from Global South countries to Global North countries. But increasingly, we see that Global North spaces of wealth extraction and resource extraction can exist in the Global South, and Global South spaces can exist in the Global North. You know, I'm in Baltimore right now, and the life expectancy in the city of Baltimore varies by 20 years. By 20 years between the richest neighborhoods and the poorest neighborhoods. And they're just a couple of blocks away in many cases. And that is staggering. So you have people who live in conditions of food apartheid, where they do not have access to healthy foods. They don't have access to regular medical care in the same ways. And the toxic burdens of industrial industrialism and those legacies live in people's bodies in this very city. So you can see those kinds of divides even within a single city. So in the global north, you'll see global south places. So, you know, that idea of like a country, a monolithic notion of a country being just a global north country is really contested now too. And just last thing I'll say about this, after I've talked for 27 and a half minutes about the global north and the global south, is that you'll see a lot of activism happening increasingly, where global south groups, organizations, activists, organizers will find unity in being global south. So you'll have Slum Dwellers International, you know, saying, you know, we are all living in global south spaces and we unite on this cause, and developing a class consciousness, I would say, developing a positionality based on their location in the global south. And when I say location, I don't necessarily mean geographic, right? It's kind of an economic and political situation where they're being systemically denied access to resources, access to wealth accumulation, to being able to make it, not getting a fair shake in the capitalist system. So very long answer to what I mean when I say global south and global south scientists, right? But it's just really hard for scholars to get a leg up because of the history that is built in to how scientific knowledge accumulates and circulates, which is to say in the global north.
Thank you so much. I feel like I've learned a lot from that answer, so I appreciate it. I actually wanted to go back, add another question. You've got so many, you're saying so many wonderful things that we keep adding questions beyond what we've actually prepped. But you were mentioning how one of the roles of the MSH major, especially in recent years, has been to think about what a fact is and what truth is in our world. And I remember you mentioning a while back that you do these icebreakers with your students. And I believe you had one that examined what a fact is. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about that and why that's useful for undergrads?
Yeah, thanks for that great question. After the pandemic, the very first semester that Hopkins went back to being in person in the fall of 21, I found that students had been away, you know, seniors and juniors had been away from the classroom for so long, and first year and sophomore students had never been in a college classroom before. So I have the very good fortune of doing work with MICA, the Maryland Institute College of Art, as an anthropologist in residence there. So I work on a lot of human-centered design projects, or a number of human-centered design projects there. And it's such a MICA thing to do icebreakers and to do activities that get people warmed up and comfortable with each other. So that semester, I thought, let me bring it here, because these students don't necessarily know how to engage with each other. I've got 16 or 18 students in a seminar style class probing these really important and difficult questions about science and medicine. And if we're all wearing masks, can't see each other's faces, it's hard to hear. And so if we're all trying to talk, it's just, there's so many factors inhibiting communication in this classroom. So I started doing the MICA thing and having a very informal icebreaker question that we would all go around the room and answer. And you didn't have to have done the readings to answer the question, which was really important. It wasn't like, what's your favorite line from the reading or something. It was like, what about you in your life and your experience? So the question would usually tangentially in some way relate to the readings. In the very beginning of the semester, it was just like, what's your favorite color and why? It was just like, let's just get students talking so everybody's voice is heard in this room. And it really worked. And so I continue to do that when I have seminar style classes. And so, yes, when we read Mary Poovey's History of the Fact, I asked everybody to just offer one fact about the place where they grew up, or a place where they grew up. So I said, what's one fact about that place? It can be a statistic. It can be that there's something located there, anything. So it wasn't even a particularly personal question. I should also say, I don't force students to talk if they don't want to. They can pass if they want to. They can skip if they're still thinking and be out and come back later. But nobody ever actually passes. Everybody always answers. It's so cool. It's really wonderful. Everybody wants to talk. The students want to engage with each other. And it creates a really open and friendly and comfortable space for everybody to talk. We also have the caveat that what's said in the classroom stays in the classroom. And that's really important, too. So they're not going out and talking about something very personal that somebody shared with their friends or something. So we have a space of trust that we develop as well. So yes, everybody offered a fact about where they came from. And some were more statistical, you know, the population of their city or a historical fact about their city. But others were a little bit more subjective, and they would say something that they felt actually about the place where they came from. And so it was really interesting for us to be able to think about different genres of facts and to look at how we even have very different notions of what constitutes a fact in the classroom. So for some people, a fact was something quantitative, for others it was qualitative, for others it was straight up subjective. And they were all useful. It was useful to hear all of them and then be able to think about this somewhat, not the easiest reading for undergrads, right? Mary Poovey writing on facts. So that was a particularly fun icebreaker that we were able to do about facts. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for asking that.
I think that is such a cool pedagogical tool. So I'm glad you got to chat about that for our listeners. I appreciate it.
Yes, definitely. Same here. And I think that's valuable exercises, especially in the medical humanities. Speaking of which, could you share with us how you personally define the medical humanities and what value do you feel they bring to society, especially in the context of the MSH program?
So as I think of the medical humanities, I think it's an inherently interdisciplinary space, interdisciplinary field, where we can use history, we can use philosophical concepts, we can use critical theory and analysis to understand how humans historically and today intervene on bodies, intervene on populations, how they order, how they value health, how they evaluate healing and knowledge about the body, all these different systems of knowledge that we can critically understand through the medical humanities. Something that's really significant in terms of the social impacts and the societal outcomes of the medical humanities is that they take apart the monolithic authority of medicine and of science so that we can more critically understand those origins. We can understand the ideologies inherent in scientific knowledge and medical knowledge and practice. We can assess the values that have developed. We can look at the contradictions in medicine and science, and we can look at the contributions too. It's not all just burn it down. Not at all. There's obviously it's the foundation of our world, science and medicine. I mean, you know, that's they're pillars of the way that we of our episteme. They're pillars of the way that we understand the world and engage with the world. They're so fundamental to our truly how we see, how we understand, how we learn, how we feel. And I think taking that apart and understanding more critically allows us to make better decisions for ourselves as individuals, but also to make better decisions and better studies and create better knowledge for society. For example, I think something really powerful that the medical humanities does is take apart the notion of objectivity, right? Places in the center of, instead of objectivity at the center of science, we place human practice, human knowledge, and meaning making at the center. And to me, that's a huge shift. Students are blown away when I teach the history of objectivity, that objectivity is itself a historical artifact. Objectivity is not a thing in the world that exists in a real way. We make objectivity, and what objectivity is has changed over time. And of course, the landmark text by Dastin and Gallison that I read in my classes, my intro class that I'm teaching, right, or the 200 level required class that I'm teaching right now. Sometimes it takes students a couple of weeks to understand that, because the notion of objectivity is so fundamental to how they understand everything, that it's possible to be objective, that that's a possibility. It's so hard for them to let go sometimes. And for the students who get it, they're immediately like, the veil is lifted and they see the world in a totally different way, to understand that objectivity is something we've made as a concept, that that concept didn't always exist. It's actually pretty recent, right? Like, it developed pretty recently. And as technologies have changed, what it means to be objective or to aspire towards objectivity has changed. And even still, some students can't get away from the idea. I was like, okay, well, we made it, but we can still try to do better and get there. I'm like, actually, no. Like, you know, there's a value to trying to understand the world in this neutral, detached way. However, we're never neutral. We're never detached. We always bring values, and they can't be accounted for in a metric, right? Why not just say objectivity is a historical artifact, and it's something that is foundational to science and the way it's practiced, but it comes with a set of practices, a history, a set of knowledges. And really, it's about meaning making for us. It says more about our world to think about the notion of objectivity than to just accept it as objectively true. So really dissolving and deconstructing that kind of notion is something that's really powerful, I think. It's one really good example of how the medical humanities can help understand meaning making as central to understanding history and science, as opposed to the notion like objectivity as being what's central.
Nice. You reminded me of the comment by Howard Zinn about objectivity, where he said you can't stand still on a moving train.
Yeah, that's fire. That's great. I'm totally going to use that, Antoine. Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you again, Nicole. But from your role within the program, we'd love to know more about you personally. Could you tell us about your research? You know, the page on the Hopkins Anthropology Department website states that your current book project is titled Sweet Monster, Culturing Sugarcane in Brazil. Is that still the working title? And we'd love to hear about that work and about your wider research focuses.
Yes. Thank you so much, Antoine, for that question. Sweet Monster is still the working title. I'm pretty into it. I really like the notion. And it works for me because that book, that manuscript, is about sugarcane. It's about this really interesting plant that's very charismatic to social scientists. There have been many very famous books written about sugarcane, Sweetness and Power by Sidney Mintz, which was a pioneering book from the 80s that really launched food studies in many ways, the anthropology of food. But it looked at labor, and it looked at the development of a taste for sweetness, of how sugar came not only to undergird the plantation colonial system, but it fueled industrial development in England in factories when people had, you know, more calories, more cheap calories to work more hours in factories, and thus continue to spur the Industrial Revolution, as it's called. So yes, this plant, this crop, this grass, sugarcane is a grass. It's the most photosynthetically capable crop plant on Earth. It's just like a little bio machine for converting sunlight into sucrose, which is energy in the form of either calories or biofuels, which is something I study as well in this work is sugarcane ethanol in Brazil. So it's based on 18 months of fieldwork in Brazil, working with various bioscientists, agronomic scientists. I worked with an amazing group of molecular biologists who were looking to make the world's first genetically modified sugarcane. At the time of my research, there was no genetically modified sugarcane because it was too difficult to modify. It's a really tricky plant, which also makes it very interesting to me. It was constantly offering resistance in the laboratory for becoming a viable transgenic, which is another word for genetically modified plant. I also worked with biochemists who were looking to develop new fermentation technologies using yeasts that were bioprospected by a different lab from various biomes around Brazil. So it always felt like a little bit of a competition on which biome, which ecosystem would produce the wild yeast that would make the best advanced ethanol, the best fermentation technology to make fuels for Brazilians to use in cars. And I worked with some agronomic economists who were looking to transfer technologies from Brazil and the Brazilian biofuel model and system to Mozambique and other post-colonial countries that Brazil felt it was similar to, where they had built so much economic strength on biofuels and on sugarcane cultivation and production. And so they looked to Mozambique, which is also a Lusophone country, meaning Portuguese-speaking country. It was formerly part of the Portuguese Empire. So they were going to Mozambique, which is one of the poorest countries on Earth, and trying to figure out ways to implement a biofuels production system there. So it was really interesting to look at these different angles and aspects of sugarcane. When I got into the research, I knew sugarcane binded all of these sites together, but I didn't realize how like obsessed with the plant I would become, mostly because the researchers are actually really obsessed with this plant. So I took a cue from them and just spent a lot of time with this plant in the same ways that they do, but with different approaches, because I'm trained as a humanistic critical social scientist, as an anthropologist of science. And so when I was in the molecular biology laboratory, you know, there's downtime. I did tissue culturing. I worked at the lab bench with them. I cut sugarcane in the fields with them to use for experimental protocols. I planted sugarcane, which was like a festival. It was, you know, a fun party that we had after we'd planted cane for future years for experimentation purposes. While they were writing up notes or studying, you know, I worked with students and postdocs and faculty and technicians and technical assistants. But in the downtime, I would just go look at these like petri dishes full of moldy, weird, overtaken, failed experiments. I would like wander around the cane field and like just see what I saw and look at the other plants that were growing there. I just kind of got interested in like what the plants were up to around the lab. I would go to the, you know, under the UV lights on the shelves and just see these little tiny plants growing culture medium, or look at the plant embryos and just kind of, I don't know, see which ones were turning brown. So yeah, it was really fun to think about this plant. And of course, think about the colonial history, right? Sugarcane has been grown in Brazil for 500 years, and it was the foundation for the enslavement of millions of people to be able to plant and process and cultivate this incredibly labor-intensive crop. It's awful, right? The conditions of cutting sugarcane manually are awful. They burn the cane the night before, so there's all these pulmonary issues that are associated with cane burning as people live adjacent to the fields. Then you go with a machete and hack at the cane in hot, dry places. It's grueling, grueling work. It's dangerous work. And so you have this 500-year history where in some places in Brazil, that's still how sugarcane's cultivated. Not in the region where I worked, that's gone mechanized in the last 10, 15 years, but you still have sugarcane working this way. It's fascinating to me how scientists are trying to take something that's 500-year-old colonial history where you have infrastructure, you have social mores and social norms premised on the plantation system. There's Stuart Schwartz writing about how sugarcane plantations are the foundation for the formation of Brazilian society in the first, you know, 200-300 years of the colonial project. So sugarcane is really important to Brazil in socially, economically, and in terms of the landscapes and how Atlantic rainforest and other parts of the country, the Amazon, the Pantanal, how these ecosystems have been altered irrevocably because of plantations, sugarcane plantations early on. So now taking this huge monocrop agriculture landscape and turning it into a foundation for a sustainable future where you're taking sugarcane and trying to make it into a biofuel to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions, to create cleaner fuels, to decrease reliance and use of fossil fuels is fascinating that in this post-colonial space, you have scientists really working ethically driven by sustainability to take this plant and make it sustainable. And they love it. They love the plant. They love the whole system. They think it's really powerful and that it's going to work. So a lot of studies on GM crops in particular and farming and anthropology look at farmers and peasants and small-scale landholders who are affected adversely by monocrop agriculture, who are affected by big agro in meaningful ways. And those are crucial studies looking at MST, the landless workers movement, right? These are really important critical studies. But for me, I said, well, let's go to the belly of the beast and see what the people with power are doing. Let's go to the scientists and see what are they thinking about? What are they up to? They're the ones with this immense amount of power who are changing the world. What are they thinking about? We don't know. So that's where I went and I talked to them. And it's just amazing to see how ethically driven they are. They really care both about ecology. They care about the earth. They care about others in the global south and south-south collaborations. And they also care about monocrop agriculture. That's meaningful for them. It's important to them. It's an answer. It's a real viable answer and within a capitalist framework for creating change. I didn't always agree at all. But that's some of the contradictions and tensions of doing research with experts. You know, it's that you have to come up against ideological differences and political differences and navigate that while still understanding the huge amount of grace and generosity that people are offering me by letting them be in their lab, by letting them look over their shoulder, by giving me their precious tissue cultures and letting me do the work of transferring them. You know, it's like this is their livelihood or their degree or whatever. So they were incredibly generous to me. And while we had differences, it was great to be able to work with them and learn from them. And at the end of the day, they were like plant geeks. That's why they were doing this. They love plants. So it was so fun for me. I've always loved plants, but I just didn't know how central plants in particular would become and how they'd become really central actors in my story.
That's so great. Thank you so much, Nicole. Sweet Monster definitely sounds like a perfect title for this. And I want to think about your work and kind of tie back to MSH a little bit and mm-hmm. thinking about how you use your research for teaching. I mean, I know we were both in the MSH department and I was smelling all of these teas that you were brewing to help teach your undergrads. And I know that you're going on a field trip with some of your undergrads to Brazil. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about how you use your interest in like place-specific work or site-specific work, you know, thinking about Brazil and how you use plants and how you use your anthropological methods to bring some of your own work to undergrads.
I love that question. That's such a fun question to think about. I love plants. I'm obsessed with plants. So something that's really important for me in teaching this, you know, the course I'm currently teaching, where it's foundational kind of competencies and knowledge about medical humanities and science and technology, we do a week on the pharmacon, on pharmaceuticals and drugs and plants and healing, which I think is something that's so fundamental to medicine, right? You know, it's a major part of medical practice. And it's also very ancient, right? Working with plants for healing is cross-cultural and is ancient. And is part of our everyday lives too, whether we know it or not. We're like, eat your greens. It's like, well, that's because there's lots of nutrients in greens that are physiologically good for you. And so we eat them. It all is part of the same kind of structure and paradigm of plants and also fungi that can have positive health outcomes. So we look at some of these complexities. You know, we read about, in that case, when we're learning about the pharmacon being a Greek word that simultaneously means poison and remedy. So thinking about how plants and plant healing can be both poison and remedy. It can be both good for us and bad for us, right? Like the opioid epidemic is a great example of that, right? Opioids are a game changer for chronic severe pain, you know, that NSAIDs just won't touch. And people can have real relief from opioids in severe end of life cases, in cancer cases, but also other kinds of chronic pain. And it's incredibly addictive and destructive and deadly pharmacon, right? Poison and remedy at the same time and this complexity. So we read Londa Scheibinger on abortifacient plants, plants that can cause abortions that enslaved women and indigenous women used in the colonial context as a form of freedom, as a form of rebellion, to say, I don't want to have children born into this system of horror. And that's resistance. That's resistance as real as any uprising, Scheibinger argues, right? You can have guns and tools, but you can also stop procreating. And that's incredibly powerful biological autonomy that these women were able to take because of this plant, peacock flower. But what I do in that class is I went to the local organic supermarket and found 18 different plants that I know of that have healing properties, some of which have been converted into pharmaceuticals, like willow bark. That one, I have to admit, I had to order online. My local organic supermarket does not sell willow bark that I saw. But willow bark became aspirin, salicylic acid, and that became aspirin, which is an incredibly widely used drug, obviously. So we had, like I said, 18 different plants, and I went and found all peer-reviewed studies that showed the healing properties of these plants. So I wasn't on like buythisherb.com to show that the garlic can be used as antibacterial. It's the scientific studies that show that are peer-reviewed and citable. So I brought in a couple of tea kettles, electric kettles, and I cut up all the herbs and vegetables and the watercress and maitake mushrooms, which again, not a plant, but a really powerful fungal healer. And oh my gosh, what did we have? I had leeks. We had rose hips. We had chamomile. I bought Pau D'Arco in. My supermarket had Pau D'Arco. We had turmeric and horseradish. That was a fun one. Only the brave students took the horseradish in their teas. it was great. It was so much fun. And we all got to sit and drink tea for class. So we did that first thing. And then I even had one student report that a student behind her had been coughing. And by the end of class, she stopped coughing. So here's hoping that the medicinal cocktail she made from the plants that I got for our tea bar worked. It seems they might have, anecdotally. Actually, afterwards, several students came up so excited and they were like, I'm going to the supermarket right now and I'm going to get plants so I can like take care of myself. And I was like, yep, you have the power. Like, it's all around you. And so teaching students that is a way to link up to the power of plants, which is something that I find very compelling and important and true. And so that's great. I also, as you mentioned, I'm co-leading a trip with my colleague, Jerry Burgess. We're taking 7 students to Brazil. We taught a course this semester called Food, Energy, Water, Power, A Global South Perspective. And Jerry, who is the director of the Earth and Planetary Science Department's undergraduate major. He teaches science of food, energy, and water, but also policy issues and historical issues related to it. But I bring the critical perspectives of understanding power relations, of understanding these history and unequal histories of and the intertwining of food, water, and energy. And it was great. It was great to co-teach with him. And now we're bringing 7 students to Brazil to see some of this in action. And so I've never led a study abroad trip, so I'm excited for it. It's going to be a blast.
I want to go. I want to go.
Yeah. You know, your work focuses a lot, as we learned today, on, you know, environmental science and climate justice. And you mentioned STS, Science and Technology Studies. And obviously, our podcast focuses more on medicine rather than science. But could you give a pitch for how these fields relate to human health a bit more in detail, and perhaps specifically how your work in these fields relate to human health?
My work on sugarcane really does focus on science and scientific knowledge, but a lot of the work I do here in Baltimore that I don't publish on or write too much about is centered on environmental justice here in Baltimore. And in here and many places, environmental justice hinges on human health in really important ways. So I work, I have the great privilege of working with the Baltimore Compost Collective, of working a bit with the South Baltimore Community Land Trust and with Black Yield Institute. They're really powerful organizations that are in various ways fighting for environmental justice and health justice for people in South Baltimore who are adversely affected by the many waste disposal practices that are positioned in South Baltimore, what they call sacrifice communities, where you have these rich parts of town that don't suffer from the environmental damages of incinerators, of a medical waste incinerator that's recently been found to be criminal, to be engaging in illegal practices that are toxic and poisoning people in the adjacent neighborhoods. So yeah, looking at how the placement of these neighborhoods that are placed in sites of industry, in the center of industry, where industry gets neighborhoods built around those neighborhoods and thinking about how they get structurally cut off from access to resources and how that affects health, right? Cherry Hill is a remarkable neighborhood. It was the first and one of the largest African-American neighborhoods that was developed in the post-war, in the post-World War II period, expressly for African-American residents of the city who were pushed out by wealthy white homeowners and by the city itself. There was, you know, the redlining was invented in Baltimore, right? The map, there's a famous map of Baltimore with red lines around which people could get home loans and which people couldn't. So Black people were forced out of the center of the city to places like Cherry Hill, which is across a bridge, surrounded by highways and has no supermarket at all. There's nowhere to get healthy, fresh food there. It's a site of food apartheid. There are not many buses coming in and out of that neighborhood. So people are really structurally cut off from the resources of the rest of the city, including access to healthy food. So Black Yield Institute had a remarkable, incredible urban garden, urban farm. It was massive. And the city took it away. It was the housing authority took it away so they could build housing on this place that for 10 years had been so productive and such a crucial, important part of people's access to food in that neighborhood and access to working the land and being in touch with the soil. And, you know, it was just a great, it was an amazing space. And unfortunately, it was shut down. That to me is it's a huge injustice to have something that's so thriving and productive. They were providing food for people in the pandemic. That was how people were getting fresh food, was from the Cherry Hill Urban Community Garden. So, you know, it relates to human health because you have, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, is a 20-year difference in life expectancy from people who live in Cherry Hill versus people who live in the neighborhood where I am, where Hopkins is, where the Hopkins Homewood campus is. And so that's a huge injustice that's right here in the city. And there are people doing incredible, incredible work to try to stop that, to try to stop the incinerator, to hold medical waste incinerator accountable for the injustices, to help people have better access to food and composting. So it's really remarkable the work that these people do. Mr. Marvin Hayes, everybody at the South Baltimore Community Land Trust, Shoshonda Campbell and Melanie Thomas and Greg Sautel, at Black Yield, the remarkable Eric Jackson, and the person who brought me to all of it. I'd be really remiss if I didn't mention Nicole Fabricant, who's an anthropologist at Towson, who started me on this path and to whom I'm incredibly grateful and whose work really is changing things. She's a radical in the best way.
Thank you so much. That was really, really great to hear for yes. both of us. To wrap up the episode, could you tell us about what you're excited about working on next? What's in the future for you? And this can either be, you know, in your own research or with the MSH program.
Yes. I mean, as far as MSH goes, I'm just so excited to see the major growing and to see so many honors projects. That's been so exciting to see undergrads doing independent research. And that has just been increasing so dramatically in the last couple of years. It's wonderful. And their research is so innovative. And you would never believe it's undergraduates doing the research. It's really top quality, amazing work. I'm working on starting to work on another project in Brazil, looking at different systems of knowledge around plants and the healing power of plants. So talking to pharmacologists, talking to ethnobotanists, and also talking to residents who live in lower income neighborhoods about their experiences and training to learn about medicinal plants and healing plants and understanding how these kinds of knowledge intersect in Brazil and in Rio in particular, where you have ethnobotanists who are really taking seriously traditional knowledge about plants and pharmacologists too. It's a little bit more, you know, it's more on the fringe. It's certainly not the norm, but it's really exciting to see researchers who are doing that work and also learning from plant healers who are not trained in academic institutions, but have an incredible amount of knowledge that they've learned basically through apprenticeship from either, you know, families or people that they know that they've grown up with. And they know so much about plants. And it's just incredible to walk through an urban neighborhood and essentially be foraging. And really, are we foraging for plants? They've planted them deliberately, or there's already something there and they know the medicinal applications for it. And so there's, you know, a lot of mistrust of the medical system for people who have experienced adverse effects or have been excluded from the official medical system, who receive less than good care in public hospitals versus private hospitals. And I mean, the Brazilian public health system is great, but yeah, it's racism and it's classism, and people experience that in really powerful and meaningful ways. So there's distrust of medicine for some people, and they've taken matters into their own hands or just always had the knowledge of which plants help. So if they have a child who has a fever or if someone's in pain and their pain isn't taken seriously, they can find plants that will help address those issues. And so they don't have to go to a pharmacy because they have it outside their door. And it's so cool. It's so remarkable. And the histories of plant healing in Brazil are fascinating. And this, you know, what you might call vernacular or more informal knowledge that when you dive into it, is not really, it's called informal because it wasn't learned in an academic setting, but there's rules and there's times of year when things get picked, and there's incredibly nuanced botanical knowledge that people leverage to have access to and utilize these plants. So it's incredible. It's humbling and exciting to work with folks who know so much. And to see those human plant engagements in various ways in Brazil. It's really exciting.
That sounds like a great project. That's really cool.
Seriously. Cool. And as we head on out, I just want to say thank you again for all of the amazing work you're doing in Baltimore and at Johns Hopkins, because I believe the work that you do in Baltimore is as important as the work you do within the institution. And thank you for spending your morning with us and such a generative conversation.
Thank you, Antoine. Thank you, Christy. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. And it's been a pleasure to listen to this podcast. And I've learned so much from so many of the episodes. So thank you. Congratulations on your incredibly exciting new endeavors. And I'm so excited I get to keep in touch with you and hear about the fabulous things that you're going to do right now as you leave Hopkins.